Welcome back to Future in Focus, a podcast from Schmidt Futures. I'm Wilson Shirley. Today, we're bringing the Future in Focus with a conversation on security and defense. I'm joined by two fellows from Schmidt Futures International Strategy Forum, Ulrike Franke from the Europe cohort and David Rader from the North America cohort. Ulrike is a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, where she leads ECFR's Technology and European Power Initiative. And David was most recently deputy director of the Global Investment and Economic Security Directorate at the U.S. Department of Defense. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to be here.
So I want to start off with a high-level question before we get into more specific questions about technology and security and defense. I think it's pretty clear that over the last few years, how Washington and Berlin are thinking about security and defense policy has changed. I'm going to try to put a date on that, on when that thinking changed. So if it's DC, you could say 2017, there's a new national security strategy. It talks about great power competition. Germany might be a little bit more recent than that. So people would point to Olaf Scholz's speech shortly after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, talking about a Zeitenwende, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Is that right?
Zeitenwende.
Okay, so I know is the answer to how my pronunciation is. First of all, do you think that those two dates of when strategic thinking has changed are correct? And how deep-seated is that change within both the United States and Germany? And I'm going to start with you, Ulrike.
Yeah, thank you very much, Wilson. So I think it is right to point to the 27th of February, 2022. That was 3 days after the invasion of Russia in Ukraine, the 2022 invasion, one has to say. And Olaf Scholz, the German chancellor, gave this speech in the German parliament and really said many things that just a few months before one would not have expected to hear a German chancellor say. So he emphasized the importance of security and defense. He announced a 100 billion fund, special fund, to be spent on the German armed forces, the Bundeswehr. He decided to buy F-35 and things like that. He decided to deliver weapons to Ukraine, a country at war. So I do believe that that is an important change. However, this whole idea of Zeitenwende, turn of the times, if you understand it as this kind of package of policies pursued by the German government, in order for this to lead to a real rethinking of German defense and security policy, this needs to be guided by the political realm. And we've seen some changes that, yes, have taken hold, and the world does look a bit different from Berlin now than it did a year ago. But there's also a kind of argument of a glass half empty, where I still believe that a lot of Germans would kind of love to go back to what they consider normal, i.e. a situation where they don't need to think about defense and security, where they can be left alone with all of this military stuff. And so I think it is really important to guide the discussion in Germany and make sure that we don't, once the war in Ukraine hopefully ends soon, that we just go back to we don't care about security and the military and we don't really want to think about.
Yeah, I think that's right. So turning to you, David, 2017, is that right?
Yeah, I too picked that date on the calendar. I think there was a lot of quiet groundswell murmur leading up to that point. But 2017, the National Security Strategy and the National Defense Strategy, all those kind of critical documents that came out in that period are when we really were able to point and say, this is now the official American position. This is our understanding of the environment and the world in which we're both in and the world in which we're heading towards. And then I also think February 2022 is the right date for describing when the Germans really also solidify their position and the way they need to prepare for the emerging and ongoing persistent threats in which we encounter both the nation state level, the supranational level, system to system level. I think those are the right dates.
So let's talk a little bit about the role of technology in today's great power competition, because obviously there are a lot of emerging technologies that everyone's talking about, but it seems like there are a couple of problems. One, we're not sure where they're going, what their applications will be. And two, governments around the world are having a lot of difficulty incorporating them into their defense posture and into their defense industrial base. So how do we think technology is going to shape this era, and how well are the United States, Germany, their allies doing in using technology to advance their security and defense policy?
Yeah, happy to start. So I think one of the great challenges we had in the department, and it's ongoing, is is trying to figure out what we need next when we plan 5 years, 10 years down the road. Because if you come to me today and you say, you know, I have an iPhone, so I'll give iPhone a plug here. So I have an iPhone. If you say, give me the next generation iPhone, it's just going to kind of look the same, but with like a little longer battery, longer life battery, and maybe a little bit of better camera, maybe a little bit lighter, because I can't, you know, start to think out what I really truly need in 2035, what I need in 2050. And so we kind of had the same problem with defense planning. We look at, you know, and emerging technology planning. So you look at what you have today and you try to modify it against the world in which you think you'll encounter, but there's no way to know. Because prior to September 11th too, I don't think we ever thought we'd have this super gray zone, you know, special operations focused environment that, you know, is proliferated around the world, you know, relevant to our core traditional military training and equipment and equipping. So you have the same with the threats we're looking at now, whether it's China, Russia, or, you know, terrorism, sub-nation state. Right now, as I sit today, I cannot tell you what we're going to need. And so that's why the departments have to be, or at least Department of Defense, but, you know, our German counterparts too, have to be very creative and adaptive and a little more flexible. Because if you start today planning these 30, 50 year, you know, acquisition pathways, you're not going to get it right because the world just moves too different. And you base it off of what you have today. And so that really handcuffs in a lot of our innovation development. Now, a commercial sector doesn't have that problem.
Yeah.
But from a defense planning, so in 2040, when I'm trying to buy the next widget, it's what I thought of in 2020. It's not what the market delivered to me in 2039.
Yeah. So how much of that resonates with your understanding of where Germany's defense posture is and Europe as a whole?
It does resonate, but I think the challenges are even bigger for Europe and for Germany. And so to come back to your question, I would actually say that Germany isn't really prepared for these changes. I mean, just to give you an example, the German government published a national strategy on artificial intelligence, and it had one sentence on the military and defense implications of artificial intelligence, and it literally said, you know, that's something for the MOD to deal with.
Oh, really?
Which, incidentally, I would argue it's not really doing. I mean, we don't have a military AI strategy, of course, there are discussions happening within the MOD that I'm not necessarily privy to, but I don't think that we're really prepared for this yet. That is something I worry about. I also worry about the fact that in Europe, and again, specifically in Germany, the approach to these new technologies, if you take them very broadly, is quite reactive and focused primarily on arms control and disarmament. So we actually do have quite a big discussion, for example, on autonomous weapons and AI-enabled weapons, so-called killer robots. But the discussion at the political level in Germany is primarily on how to regulate or ban those and, you know, how to come up with new arms control treaties, which, don't get me wrong, super important and a great thing to pursue, but that's not good enough, I think, as a country. That's just one side of the coin, really. And then I think there is the impact of the current war in Ukraine. And I think it's a kind of double-sided sword as well, because on the one hand, you have the realization that new technologies do matter. I mean, we have, you know, apps being used and AI-enabled traffic cameras being used and drones, obviously all of that. And people in Europe and in Germany are realizing that. But at the same time, the war in Ukraine is also reminding us that old stuff, old equipment, dumb tank, artillery,
howitzers, like, Leopard.
Exactly. All of this really matters. And we also need to invest in those because we basically thought that they weren't as relevant anymore and really got rid of a lot of them. And so this is another challenge where, on the one hand, yes, you need to think about and invest in all of the new stuff, and I very much support this, but you can't underestimate the importance of the old stuff. So you need to do everything, which of course is a budget problem.
Yeah, so to use a cliche, you have to walk and chew gum at the same time in terms of current platforms and what's coming in the future, what David talked about a little bit ago. And thank you for bringing up the war in Ukraine again. Because I want to focus on how that war is changing how the Department of Defense is thinking about technology and innovation going forward. So what lessons has the U.S. government learned over the last year?
I think how important and effective cheap equipment is. I hate to say it that way. You know, we spend so much on big, heavy drones that we're used to. And then you're starting to see, you know, the footage from Ukraine using small DJI-style drones dropping grenades into trenches. And you're thinking, geez, this is somewhere between like a trebuchet and like a personal, you know, drone. So why do we spend all this on these other pieces of equipment? And so I think probably shifting to that mindset of how can we, you know, deploy the same capabilities or employ these tactics the same way the Ukrainians are, or, you know, the Russians are, and what is it going to look like when that comes to us? And so, if we have to fight the next great war, are we prepared to have 100 small drones dropping grenades in trenches over us? We have great anti, air systems, great surface-to-air missiles. I mean, those are designed to shoot down advanced next-gen fighters, not little drones. And can you spend $100,000 on a missile to shoot down a, $400 drone at scale? No. The economics of it outweigh the benefit of it, but that's the threat in which we've been encountering. And so moving this out of, that's a special operations problem, or that's a, a gray zone, subkinetic kind of like unique problem set, we're realizing this is a core military problem all the way down to, the individual kind of militia style problem.
So Ulrika, you talked about the role of government in regulating innovation, and that's sort of a Germany's approach as you see it right now. And that brings up the role of the private sector as well, because a lot of the innovations that are happening here are not, in fact, government-led. Over the last few decades, government research and development spending has gone down a significant percentage, while the private sector, it's been private companies who have been leading in this area. So I'd like you both to talk a little bit about the role of the private sector in defense and security and how government and the private sector can work together to advance shared goals.
Yeah, no, a perfect question, because I, when David was answering, I was also thinking what are the big lessons that one can draw from the war in Ukraine? So far, obviously, it's still ongoing. And the first thing I wrote down in my notes was indeed this point about the importance of, and to a certain extent, the dependence on private companies. And I think the prime example currently in Ukraine is Starlink, and the fact that the Ukrainians still have internet, which is super important also for their military operations, is due to a private company. And as we're also seeing with the discussion in recent weeks about, Elon Musk maybe not being so keen anymore in providing this service to the Ukrainian military, the way that we are dependent on the kind of goodwill almost of private companies. And so I think this is a huge challenge. This is a huge challenge for MOD, so Ministry of Defense in particular, because they tend to be, and I think this is true pretty much all over the world, they tend to be pretty big and pretty slow bureaucracies, and they are not really good at dealing with especially startups that need to move fast, the kind of whole moving fast and breaking things. It's not something that military bureaucracies usually
Yeah, they're
usually
more focused
like.
On breaking things.
And so I think this is something that we need to take on. But quite honestly, I think one lesson here is also that maybe more things need to be done again at least with the funding and under the control of the state. Maybe we have gone a bit too much private, and there are dependencies here that shouldn't be there. It can't be that our military capabilities depend on the goodwill of the CEO of a private company. Like, that sounds like a terrible idea. So tackling that is kind of high on my list of things that we should learn from the war in Ukraine.
So Ulrika brought up funding. She brought up dependency on private sector actors. Do you agree with that, David? And are there other things that the U.S. is considering in this area?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I'm glad you brought up space, because space is a perfect, it's very indicative of the inversion of the relationship. In the 50s to the 80s, it was U.S. government's the client, space industry, go do this, make this for us.
Yeah.
This is what we want to look like. And now it's flipped to where it's the space industry is doing this and the department is a consumer. And we say, hey, can we buy one of your rockets? Can we buy one of your,
Yeah, for a long time, the U.S. couldn't even send astronauts into space on our own shuttles.
Exactly. So you're seeing that shift. Now, of course, space is a unique innovation ecosystem, vertical, et cetera. Now, once you move over to different ones, yes, and the relationship now changes back to more traditional. So the department just stood up the Office of Strategic Capital. The funding line on it, will be released eventually. But that's designed to help us push market in directions that we see favorably. So a perfect example is quantum or supercomputing, where I can't tell you right now that I need quantum on my phone, but I can tell you, and the private sector is trying to develop quantum, but if the U.S. government places a lot of money into it, we can accelerate that, we can grow it, and then turn it back to the market to commercialize, so it becomes, the standard protection mechanism on my phone, akin to what we do with GPS. The department created it, turned to the private sector, they cleaned it up, now it's on my iPhone, that's how Uber knows where I am. That's how Google Maps knows where I am, but we don't have that with some of these others with AI and machine learning. So the department's wholly aware of that and really trying to play a role. And it comes down to both failures and successes by the private and the public sector. You know, the incentives are very misaligned sometimes. Some of the private sector entities only care about making money and hey, that profit. Some care about national security, and some are somewhere in between. The department sometimes is, everything is secret, we can't tell you, just go make the cool thing. And sometimes, you know, open kimono, this is what we need, please work with us, and here's the money to do it. And so trying to find that balance in the kitchen, if you will, is something the department's going through right now. And then, you know, you can talk all day about budget with Congress and acquisition. Those are two of the other big hurdles. They're not specifically department generated, but they definitely impact our ability to incentivize innovators and inventors to get us next great tech and helps be better partners.
Can I make an additional point just from the European perspective? Because obviously this is something that impacts the US and the European countries in the same way. However, there's even an added level of difficulty for the Europeans because it's a bunch of different countries. And so there's always this problem that when you work with the private sector, there's a question of like, a private company from which country? You know, as a German, are you okay to buy from a French company? You should be. That's the whole idea of kind of, you know, the European single market, the idea of European sovereignty, all of the things that we're discussing. But when push comes to shove, of course, there's this idea like, but this should also benefit our own economy. And so there's this kind of added level of difficulty here for the Europeans. And we see this time and time again, and it just leads to certain inefficiencies because it means that projects need to be done by several companies from several different countries, and that drives prices up and things like that. So that's something that we need to tackle kind of on top of everything we just discussed.
So that brings up the theme of global cooperation, or at least democratic cooperation around tech issues. You talked about Europe just then, but there are a lot of different technology alliances, technology groupings that are happening around the world. The Quad has its own version. There's the US and the EU have a trade council as well. What do you think the new models in democratic technology cooperation are getting right? And where do we need to do more? And let's start with you, David.
You nailed it with, I think, of the NATO Diana Fund. It's going to be, you know, it's $1 billion. There's a level of statism already occurring within it, which quite frustrating. And the U.S. has that too, where we say, we want the best tech in the world. They say, great, that company's not U.S., but it's Canada or Germany or whatever. And we kind of put up walls around that. So you can't get the best tech if you only look in 50 states, the same way the Europeans can't and the Israelis can't and the Australians can't, right? It's just the technology and commerce is too global and too fast moving for us to build these barriers. You know, and I'm the big technology transfer protection guy. So, you know, I acknowledge the risks that are associated. So that's one of the big issues they're getting wrong. The one thing that I see that I'm really excited about is the cooperation, though. I mean, I've never seen this level of support and buy-in from the private sector as I have over the last 3 to 5 years. You know, investment banks, hedge funds, private equity, venture capital, technologists, one person, two person shops, international forum. It's been the most pronounced, structured, and meaningful that I've ever seen.
Yeah, I think especially around Ukraine, you've seen a lot of private sector involvement. So Ulrika, do you agree with that? Where do you see as an opportunity for more cooperation? Where are we getting things wrong?
So I think we are getting things right where we focus more on cooperation between partners and allies. So you mentioned the US-EU Trade and Technology Council, TTC, and efforts like that. And that may surprise some people, but I think we need to be careful not to go too broad and too large, because I think these cooperations will only work and lead to something substantial if there's a lot of trust. And trust usually means a small group of really like-minded people, and not just a group of people that pretend to be like-minded but aren't really. And we're already seeing these problems, for example, within NATO, which after all is, you know, super tight-knit group, you would think, and there's a lot of, you know, intelligence sharing here. But you already have members in NATO, and by the way, also in the EU, where you're kind of thinking, maybe you need to be careful what you share with them.
Yeah, I think we can all think of who you're thinking of right now.
Exactly. And so, and if you don't have the trust, you can't really work together. So I would make an argument for, yes, definitely international cooperation, but in order for this to work, the groups need to be reasonably small and, you know, really like-minded and trustworthy partners. And just for the sake of saying, okay, now we have a 50 country group, that may sound great, but may in fact be too large. So yeah, keep it small and keep it trustworthy.
Yeah. And this question of like-mindedness, when, what does it actually mean? How tight can these coalitions actually be? that comes up in sort of the big topic that we haven't raised so far, and that's China. So Germany has taken a really interesting position on China. It's part of the EU. The EU has said that China poses a systemic risk to the EU. It's a systemic competitor to the EU. But Germany also does a pretty active job of courting Chinese investment for a variety of reasons. There was the port in Hamburg deal. Olaf Scholz was the first Western leader to visit China in the post-COVID era. It was a pretty brief visit, though. So what's the view in Germany and maybe EU writ large on technology competition with China? Does it resonate as deeply as it does in the United States? Because here, it's basically everything the defense professionals are talking about.
It definitely doesn't resonate as much for various reasons. And it's not just the tech elements. For Europe, it is an enormous challenge at the moment to kind of balance, on the one hand, its relationship, very close, very important relationship to the US, and its own interests and particular, but not solely economic interests when it comes to China. Because I would argue that for the US, it's now become rather clear that China is the systematic competitor or even opponent, and there are calls for decoupling and all of this. For the EU, for the Europeans, and for Germany in particular, it's just not as clear. This has to do with the fact that while, of course, the EU and the Europeans are part of the West, and we do have a Western-led order that China is challenging to some extent, this Western-led order, after all, is also very American. And so the real competition in terms of hegemony is between the US and China and not so much between, Europe and China. And so there's just less of an urgency, I guess, for Europe to counter China's rise. That's number one. And the other problem, of course, is economic dependencies. And China is a really important market. Now, don't get me wrong and don't get the German discussion wrong. Interestingly enough, it was the Association of German Business that a few years ago pushed most strongly for a new relationship with China, because they were actually saying, it's true that we have economic relationships with them, but they're also, stealing intellectual property, and we realize that there are geopolitical elements to be taken into account. So it's not as if you can say the German industry wants to just keep great relationships with China and the geopolitical crowd doesn't. But yeah, there's definitely a tension, and I think this is a tension in the US-EU or US-Europe relationship, because the world and the US-China competition just looks slightly different from Europe than it does from the US. And yes, the technological element is one part of it. But here again, the interests are slightly different, because a lot of the technology that we talk about is actually being produced in the US. And you have Google and Facebook and all of this. And not only is this US and not Europe, so you can say we care less, Europeans also have some issues with these companies, whether it's Google or Facebook or anything with regard to privacy and all of this. So it's just, we definitely are on the side of the US, big picture speaking, but when it comes to the details, the water gets a bit more muddy.
Yeah, and the positions are very, very different, as you said a second ago. David, does that spark anything with you?
We've seen great continuity between the Trump administration and the Biden administrations on our approach to China.
It's actually a bipartisan consensus at this point.
Right. And, we're coming off the heels of the China spy balloon. Whether that's a big deal or not, it's kind of immaterial, just to say, though, that our government is wholly aware on both parties, almost at a level of complete control, that China has been pretty bad market actor towards the United States to a certain degree. I actually would argue that we shouldn't use the word competition with China, because competition is a good thing. We compete with France, we compete with Australia, we compete with Germany. We're actually in a confrontation / conflict.
Yeah, and competition also requires agreed upon rules.
Exactly. So the divorce from competition with China causes us to have a different approach to it. But of course, we're so connected, and rightfully so, with our European counterparts, brothers and sisters, especially when it comes to the NATO framework, that we have to be cognizant of how they view it. And I think, there's been some good middle ground found and discovered between the two. For example, as a sign of the port of Hamburg, the president made a very compelling argument to the chancellor to say, hey, we don't think this is in your best interest. And to which the chancellor said, thank you so much, and I'll now do what's best for Germany, to which the United States respected and could have tried maybe different things and maybe did. But as far as the outcome, it looked there were some pretty good walls and lines drawn, and we supported our German colleagues on their decision. With that being said, there are some other areas where, of course, we think the Europeans have a you know, a different view of China that we wish they would come around on, especially when it relates to critical technology, you know, bioweapons, AI, machine learning, all the above. So, yeah, it's one of those that although the U.S. has made its position clear towards China, our position through the European Union to get to China, we remain, I think, quite respectful, honestly, of the European position and quite thoughtful of their different perch of the world.
Yeah, and that respect between partners is key. Sorry, Ulrika, you had something you wanted to share.
Yeah, I wanted to add something because I thought it was really interesting that you talked about the kind of continuity of Trump and Biden. And this relates to what we said at the beginning of the podcast, where basically said, you know, the U.S. started rethinking certain things in 2017, while the Germans did this in 2022. And I think this is exactly what we're seeing at the moment. I think what's happening is that this whole idea and ideal of a liberal world order and a globalization effort that leads to countries becoming more democratic, you know, economic development everywhere, and in the end we all become friends and are developed and are democratic and all of this. This ideal died later in Europe and in Germany in particular than it did in the US.
The end of history ended later.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So the end of history and this ideal that I was just describing was something that was enthusiastically embraced in Europe and particularly in Germany. It sounded great and it worked so well with our beliefs. And so I think it literally took until the beginning of the war in Ukraine that we started realizing that somehow this doesn't seem to materialize. So the idea of, you know, Wandel durch Handel, so change through trade, where you just, you know, have economic relationships with a country and eventually you become ever closer, and economic relationships mean economic development, and economic development means a rise of democracy and the middle class demanding more democracy. These beliefs were very enthusiastically embraced in Germany.
And in the United States for a while, too.
Absolutely. But I think in the United States, it was just abandoned a few years before. And Germany was still kind of, you know, working with this. And this has definitely been understood now with regard to Russia. But this also plays a lot with regard to China. And so this is why the European debate maybe, to some extent, lags behind the American. Again, there are some different interests, and they will always be there. So I'm not saying that in 5 years' time, Germany will be where the U.S. is now, but I think it explains also why the debates are slightly different.
Sure. I think it's going to be hard for any of us to say where things are 5 years from now, but I'm actually going to challenge you to do more than that with the last question that we're going to ask, which is, we've talked a lot about threats. We've talked a lot about things to be concerned about, but there's also a lot to look forward to. I'm an optimistic person. So say it's the year 2050, you're looking at your field. What are you most excited about? And then we can return to worries. What are you also most worried about in your field?
U.S. markets right now capitalized about $56 trillion, $46 trillion in public money, $10 trillion in private money. And the last number I saw was $2 trillion of dry powder on the sidelines. So that means there's $2 trillion of private money that could be directed in meaningful ways, whether that's the next, you know, AI platform, machine learning, biotech, healthcare. There's a lot of money waiting to come flood in and help build and really grow and accelerate our innovation in these spaces. Public-private partnership on this means we'll all start really getting online on trying to solve problems that matter, whether it's around the climate or energy crisis or energy short, food shortage. A lot of these issues that before were, oh, well, that's your problem, or, well, the private sector will solve that or the government will solve that, we're really starting to team up on. So I'm super optimistic about that.
Okay. That's a lot to be optimistic about.
Yes, that's right. It's the whole world's working together, except for, of course, when it's not. So,
okay, is that the worry?
Worrisome is the distractions. So things like Russia, Ukraine. I mean, that's making us have a level of distraction from our China problem set that we, you know, from the U.S. side, where there's a level of optionality for us to to prioritize and where we triage issues, and they will constantly keep coming up as the world turns. Terrorism is not going away. Turkey just had this horrible, and Syria had a horrible earthquake, and rightfully so, we need to go and help them. But in the same vein, that draws resources from other places, and these things keep happening. And so that's the constant worry, is we're constantly focusing on all these issues that come up because we need to, and that distracts us from long-term strategy and meaningful movement towards real long, you know, gray rhino problems that are very visible in front of us, but we're not really chipping away at right now.
Okay, so in order to make progress on 2050, we need to be thinking about 2050.
Exactly.
Longer term. Ulrika, what about you?
So I love that David is optimistic because I'm not really. So I'm worried about 2050, in particular when it comes to the whole topic of climate change. I think this is the big issue that we're not tackling sufficiently, especially because even if we were to turn this around now and go carbon neutral tomorrow, we still would need to have to deal with climate change in the next decades. And I think there are a lot of kind of security elements to climate change that, yeah, we can't even imagine yet. So this is something I'm really worried about. I do have trouble to come up with something I'm excited about. I'm afraid that's, maybe a risk of my profession. But I'm going to say something that could turn out to be good is maybe a bit counterintuitive, but European cooperation, European sovereignty, spurred by the war in Ukraine. I mean, right now, there are some good elements to this and some bad elements to this, but I do retain some hope that because of everything we're seeing now, the Europeans realize that they need to be able to do more things by themselves, that they can't always rely just on the US, that the world is a dangerous place. And so hopefully by 2050, we will have a more sovereign, if you like, more united Europe with regard to defense and security.
Okay, that is an optimistic note to end on. Thank you so much for coming to the ISF Global Summit. And I hope that you're both right on the optimistic notes and wrong on the pessimistic notes.
Excellent.
Same.
All right.
Thank you a lot for having us.
Thank you for tuning in to Future in Focus, a podcast from Schmidt Futures. We hope you've enjoyed these conversations about the future of science, technology, and global affairs. Future in Focus is produced by Caroline Hartman and Brooke Engerman. We'd like to thank our guests for providing their insights and expertise, and all of you for listening. Make sure to follow us on your favorite podcast platform, and stay tuned for more exciting episodes of Future in Focus from Schmidt Futures, a philanthropic initiative founded by Eric and Wendy Schmidt. At Schmidt Futures, we bet early on exceptional people making the world better. We bring these talented people together in networks and prove out their ideas and solve hard problems in science and society. To learn more about our method and the diverse types of capital and tools that we deploy, visit www.schmidtfutures.com.